I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special edition of Word of Mouth. Today, NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with Patricia Cornwell, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Cornwell splashed onto the scene in 1990 with the crime novel Postmortem, which she wrote after working for 6 years at the office of the Chief Medical Examiner of Virginia. The book became a bestseller and introduced readers to Dr. Kay Scarpetta, a forensic pathologist who is uncannily good at solving murders based on examination of the victim's corpse.
I open the photographs he just emailed and note the soaked grass and red mud inside Briggs Field's fence. Then I zoom in closer on the dead woman wrapped in white. The body's been deliberately posed. I'm sure of it. And the flutter in my stomach is fear.
Scarpetta may not be the warmest of heroines. We do get clues about her dark past and sometimes see her flashing impatience and unbending desire for justice duking it out with her scientific clinical reserve. Scarpetta and her equally flawed colleagues and family have driven Cornwell's book sales well over the $100 million mark worldwide. Scarpetta is credited for inspiring the development of popular television series like CSI, Dexter, and Bones.
Based on decomp, I'd estimate he's been here for approximately 3 days, but Cam should probably make that determination.
Patricia Cornwell's 21st novel is called Dust. When the book opens, Dr. Kay Scarpetta has just returned from investigating the harrowing scene at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, where 20 children were killed by a depraved gunman in December of 2012. On stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, I asked Patricia Cornwell whether, when watching the real-world news, she thinks about how her fictional characters would experience these events, or in this case, respond.
Well, it's inevitable that that always is filtered through my mind about how Scarpetta would see things and what she would say. She lives in the same world that all of us do. And for me to keep writing the same types of books I did 10 or 20 years ago when the world is different and the crimes are different would not make much sense. And it would actually not even be fair. So the Sandy Hook thing is a really unusual situation in this particular work or any work because of the way it happened. Ordinarily, I don't just infuse modern or real crimes in my books. And I'd already started Dust when, almost a year ago in December, ironically, I happened to be in Washington, D.C., and I was having a visit with Senator Orrin Hatch. This has nothing to do with politics, so don't anybody get upset.
You're starting already.
No, it's just that, you know, I've known him forever because of his, he used to be head of judiciary. We used to have some projects together that had to do with law enforcement. And we were having a big talk about some of the very problems that were about to happen. Even as I was sitting in his office, we're talking about crime and violence and the trends and the problems with these shooting sprees in public places and these sorts of things. And I go walking out into his sitting room as I was leaving, and this was all over the flat screens on the wall. We didn't even know it had happened as I was sitting there. And all the way back to Boston, I was following the news of this unthinkable atrocity. A couple things went through my mind. In addition to the obvious things that have gone through everybody's minds about this, I thought, first of all, I'm so frustrated that Scarpetta doesn't really exist and doesn't really have this headquarters in Massachusetts, because she would be in the car right now heading to Newtown to help her colleagues. And frankly, I can't think of anyone better to deal with the families than our fine lady. And then I thought, and what would this do to her? Because I have put her through about everything you can possibly imagine. She's killed people, almost been killed. The lady's a wonder she still speaks to me. But never has she been through something quite like this. And so I said, you know what? Let's do it. I'm going to give these people in Newtown the best I've got. I'm sending Scarpetta in. Dust opens. She's just been there. I don't show you that case, obviously. But she's been there, and she's haunted by these impressions, and she's actually quite undone. Mm. We see her at the most vulnerable that you will ever see her in any of my books, where her reaction is to come down with the flu. I mean, she just gets sick, and she thinks it's just, you know, Marino says it's because she took a flu shot, and she tries to remind him that's really not the way it works. But she is at a very low point, and of course the phone rings at 3 or 4 in the morning, and there's a case that she has to respond to. Did you want a short question
to
my question?
I want a conversation.
You know, I do think in 500-page increments. I warn you about that. But But that terrible tragedy also set the tone for the rest of the book, because she deals with a similar type of killer. Somebody who does some of what they're motivated by, the people today, these killers, is the attention.
Mm-hmm. Benton refers to it as a spectacle killing.
That's what Benton Wesley, her FBI profiler husband, calls this type of killer. And that is, I think, unfortunately, this is something that I never used to see in the early days. This is new. I mean, I remember with Columbine that one of my medical examiner friends said, this opens the gate, and when the more it opens, the more it will happen. And unfortunately, I think that's what we're seeing, and this is part of what my characters are addressing in this book.
She is rattled. She's unnerved. These scenes keep repeating in her head, which is something we haven't seen, as you just acknowledged, from Kay Scarpetta. And that leads to a question from the audience about how do you keep a recurring character fresh? Does she have to go through these kind of mutations?
She has to go through them because in real life she would. Yeah. She would if she's an honorable person and true to her profession, which is a self-sacrificing profession. She serves the public. And frankly, I mean, she is the last doctor some people are going to ever see, and she knows the responsibility of that, not just for those people who can't speak anymore and tell their story, and she will get it out of them somehow, but also for those they leave behind, because justice is really for them. That is for, you know, the families and the loved ones, for anybody that's left in the aftermath, not just of violence, but of terrible loss. And I do think she's a gift because she helps us to look at things that are really hard. And even while doing so, at the end of the day, we feel we're better off from having been on that journey with her.
In this book, she's commenting on how Benton Wesley, when in pursuit of a predator, is just singularly focused. That's all he can think about. And I wonder what it's like to live with you while you were going through a novel. Are you singularly focused?
I think that if you were to auction me off, most people would say, forget it, you know? She's probably not real easy to live with. I am singularly focused, and fortunately, my partner is very patient and helpful because I've always got something in my mind. Even if I've finished a book, I'm already thinking about the next one. And I do research that it's like range marks on leather, you know, when a cow backs up against the barbed wire, and distressed leather is supposed to be pretty, but it hurts to get it. And every time I do some of the research I do, I get another range mark in my hide because I do real things and see real things, and many of them are very painful. I always say, you know, I created Scarpetta, but now she's created me because I'm not the same person from having to live her life. But I'm also able to do it with an authenticity and a passion because I care about the same things that she does.
Well, you also create the criminals. You're traveling into the killer's mind, and as Scarpetta goes through these procedures and autopsies, she always says, the body speaks to me. You know, the body's telling her something. Do you go into a dark place when you're creating a criminal as well as Scarpetta?
Not as dark as you might think. I go into what the killer does and who it is enough so that we have the evidence and the wherewithal to catch this person. Then usually we catch them in a way that punishes them but good, because I don't like these people. And so I don't really care what they like to eat or what their mother was like, and I don't want to know their backstory. I just want them out of the way.
A lot of people are asking about your research, by the way. Procedures have changed so much since you first started writing these books, and it's been a long time since you've worked at the Chief Medical Examiner's Office. So how do you stay current?
Well, I still do research. For example, in Dust, two of the real innovations you're going to see, and you may have seen them in a couple of my earlier books, more recent ones, I mean, is that the whole advent of using imaging. Mm-hmm. The same type of imaging we're using on living people, CT scans, even MRIs, for example, we're also using on the dead now. A lot of your more modern medical examiner facilities have these very high radiation CT scanners, so they can get these amazing three-dimensional images of the body inside and out before they ever take a blade to it. So Scarpetta's doing that imaging. She's also doing, I'll throw a big word out there, she's doing postmortem angiography in this book, where she's injecting dye into blood vessels because she has suspicion that the first victim she works on might have had an underlying problem that caused her to die before someone actually had a chance to kill her, because there's something that's not adding up about what she's seeing. So we watch her do a procedure that generally is always only been done on living people who still have a circulation. So I find out these things from the real people who are doing them. I go visit places, I watch it, and I learn it so I can show it to you.
CSI, NCIS, Cold Case Unit, a lot of them have obviously taken the Kay Scarpetta character and changed her in some ways. I know you've considered movies for Kay Scarpetta. Have you ever thought of a television series?
Actually, I'm in the process of developing one right now that's a brand new character named Greta Stone, who's a young woman police investigator with very special gifts and a very special background, and we're developing the pilot for ABC.
Wow.
So we'll hope that the pilot really works and it launches it into a dramatic series, because I think all of you will love Greta. She has that precision and the ability to dissect a case like Scarpetta does, but she's not using a scalpel because she's not a forensic pathologist. Mm-hmm. She's more of the Sherlockian deductive, those sorts of skill sets that she has. As far as all the other shows, I'm just delighted that all these shows could be inspired by my hard work, and I'm lying because I'm not. When I first realized that the market was flooded with all these things, you know, I've been a good sport about it, but I thought, why didn't I think of this? You know, what a dummy. I should have been trying to do that myself. But, you know, we're still trying to get Scarpetta to the big screen. I have a movie deal that's been a number of years in development. We're still in the dog days of trying to get the right script. But Fox 2000 at the moment is hopeful that maybe by next fall we'll finally be in production for it. So you'll know more about it as I do, but we haven't given up on that. She's stubborn. I think she goes and has lunch in Hollywood, and then we turn around, she's disappeared again. So
well, I'm sure it was a good lunch.
She's
though.
Probably busy, you know, I don't know.
A load of people are asking about the possibility of a film, and I know that Angelina Jolie has been attached to the idea of playing Scarpetta since 2009, but I'm wondering, as many people are, who you envision as Kay Scarpetta. And people are asking, Marino, George Clooney as Benton. Everybody likes that idea out
Scarpetta
there.
Scarpetta likes that. I think we could talk her into that, actually. My vision for Scarpetta, sorry?
Meredith Baxter Burney. Not bad. She's aged beautifully, like I imagine Scarpetta has.
Yeah, well, she's kind of quit aging. I stopped that a while ago. I said, it's now really a shame because I can't ask her what she feels about hot flashes because she doesn't have them yet. So, but I have to leave her in a certain airspace or I'll be writing her retirement book, and I don't want to do that. But, you know, my image of whoever would play Scarpetta, and I know this will shock you, I do not have any one person in mind.
No.
It just needs to be somebody that when the movie opens, and wherever Scarpetta is, I mean, she might be cooking in her kitchen or getting in her car and going somewhere, who knows, or showing up at a courthouse, I want us to feel she just walked in, and we're looking at her. I mean, I want to sort of cry, because it's going to be a very moving experience for me, unless it's done badly. Then I'll probably cry for another reason. But I want to feel I'm looking at this lady, because like the rest of you, I've never really seen her either. I mean, people, I guess, assume that she's fully formed in my head. She's not. She's more of an impression. I know what she thinks. I know what she feels. I know what she's seeing when she's looking at something, because I'm inside her head. But I don't really see her. I mean, I've always thought, wouldn't it be amazing to walk in a room and she's at the same cocktail party and she's over there on the sofa? And I would say, we haven't formally met, but, you know, I'm, you know who? And she goes, who? Who? You know, the one who writes all those books about you, what books? Because that's the thing. I know who she is, and what if she doesn't know who I am? I might hurt my feelings just
a
little bit.
Yeah, that would be tough.
And now I'm really sounding like a crazy person.
The thing about the books is there's so much depth of personality. There are so many psychological undercurrents about relationships. I mean, we know these people on some level. We know how Lucy behaves. We know how Marino behaves. How does that come across in a film?
The whole beauty of writing is that the very act of reading makes you a creative person, because you are creating the same way an author does. I mean, you're seeing what somebody looks like. You're hearing the sound of the voice. The rainstorm is the way you remember one that was similar. So it becomes highly personalized when it goes through the filter of our own brains and our own imagination, which is very different from watching a movie where you're seeing something being acted out. So it's not possible that when one of these films is finally made, it's going to be exactly the way you've seen the Scarpetta world in your head all these years. Mm-hmm. And I always try to warn people and remind them, when the day comes, try to look at it as something that you enjoy, but it doesn't have to change the way you interpret things. I mean, if you were able to take a photograph of Benton Wesley and everybody's head in this room, it'd be a different picture each time, because that's what makes reading so wonderful. You get to create while you're doing it.
best-selling crime fiction writer Patricia Cornwell there for Writers on a New England Stage. She was talking about the challenges of adapting her Kay Scarpetta crime novels for film and other media. When we come back, we'll speak more with Patricia Cornwell about her new novel, Dust, and her process of letting characters speak for themselves. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special edition of Word of Mouth. Today, NHPR and the Music Hall in Portsmouth present Writers on a New England Stage with Patricia Cornwell. In the first part of the program, Patricia Cornwell described Kay Scarpetta as a character with a will of her own. Indeed, millions of readers have come to know Scarpetta's habits, her well-appointed homes, her love of cooking, her loving but distracted husband, Benton Wesley, and her feisty niece, Lucy Farinelli. In the new novel, Dust, Cornwell reveals a pivotal scene between Dr. Kay Scarpetta and her longtime collaborator, Pete Marino. In Dust, Marino and Scarpetta are no longer colleagues, but recall a time when they were very close. I asked Patricia Cornwell what she'd care to share about the new revelations.
Well, this was a little unusual what I did, because you have Scarpetta, you know, she's getting over the flu. Her fever has just broken, and you know how it is when you're sort of awake but not awake, and then you have a very vivid dream that's almost more like a flashback. The rain beating on the roof in her house in Cambridge carries her back to a rainy summer day 20 years earlier when she was packing up her life and was surrounded by boxes in her garage with the door wide open, listening to the rain, and she's getting ready to leave Richmond. And she thinks Benton Wesley is dead, and this is a low moment for her. Marino's sitting there with her, and they're smoking cigarettes and drinking beer. And you get a very much a different sort of peephole into their relationship in their early days together. But I think you're going to really enjoy that scene, especially if you're familiar with the series, because I'm going to show you something you never saw before that happened way back then.
How carefully do you plot out those kind of reveals? Because we learn more about our character in each novel. We learn in this one she goes back to Miami to her home on 79th Street and has some very vivid memories. And I'm just wondering if that is something that just flows through you. Do you plot it out? How carefully planned is that kind of revelation of Kay's character?
It's not planned. No. I try to go through that looking glass and sort of take on her persona so I can write about her. And while I'm doing it, it goes where it's going to go. I mean, of course, I'm following the evidence in a logical fashion. I know how cases work, and within reason, I do things the way they would be done, and that's sort of the structure or backbone of a book, is what is she going to do next? What would she do next? But there's so much else in terms of where her imagination goes or her emotions go, and there's something that happens in this book that brings back memories of her being a little girl and her father taking her to see the elephants when the circus would come to town. And that becomes a very poignant scene because she is in Miami. The case has taken her there. Miami's where she's from. And I think it's one of the more moving moments in the whole book because just seeing these elephants crossing the street just creates this tidal wave of memories for her that sort of put her entire life into perspective. And that's how we learn more about who she is, because the key to Scarpetta's success isn't just the technology and how she works crimes. It's also the magic of her personality and who is this person and what is it like to be her.
I've spoken with many writers who have talked, especially if they have recurring characters, who feel like the readers project upon them the attributes of the characters. And we have a lot of questions that ask, for example, do you cook as much as Kay does, and do you like wine as much?
I don't cook as much as she does anymore because my partner is a really good cook, and oftentimes I'm not allowed in the kitchen. And so even though I'm the one with cookbooks, and this is a real running joke in the house, and so we do make pizza together and do other things like that, but I do know how to cook. I have done cookbooks. In fact, if you want to make your fans upset, write a Scarpetta book and don't have her cook anything in it. I get tons of complaints about that. And so I say to her, I don't care if you're stuck in a hotel room this entire book, you are going to cook. You're going to go to Walmart and buy some cookware and a stovetop, and by God, you're going to make spaghetti or something like she did in Red Mist when they were in quarantine for a while. And so that's really important. I like wine, but she actually has more refined taste than I do. I admit it. I'll throw back and knock back a couple really good gin and tonics, you know. Sometimes my taste is really more similar to Marino's. I also like things that are disgustingly bad for you. Stuff that Scarpetta, just read my lips, she does not eat cheese spread. I do.
Sometimes, though, I wonder about you and Lucy. We have a question here about how long you've had your pilot's license, and I've heard you have a pilot's license, and
yes,
you have helicopter and jets. And how long, by the way, have you had a pilot's license?
Since 1999.
And where's the furthest you've flown and the most exciting trip you had?
With helicopters, I mean, when you're going to take a long trip, you have to be reminded it's slow because compared to a plane, it's very slow. So usually a long helicopter trip for me would be a two-day trip where you fly like from Boston to Miami. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, a good 6 hours a day in the cockpit, which is pretty tiring, to say the least. The most fun is flying along the shoreline, especially if you go all the way to Key West, and you're seeing the reflection of your helicopter in that greenish-blue, beautiful, shallow water, and you can see sea turtles and stingrays and all that from 500 feet above, and that's really quite beautiful. And, you know, I learned to fly because I wanted Lucy to be a helicopter pilot. Back in those days, and this was probably around 1994, you know, you just didn't hear about women flying helicopters. And I said, she should. And I'd been flown in them, so I was very interested in them. So I started taking lessons so I could write about her doing it. And as I say, the characters also create me, because then I became a helicopter pilot. She drives outrageously fast, powerful cars. I know it's a tough life. Somebody has to do it, so I had to learn to drive Ferraris. And then it was the motorcycle. So in scuba diving, all these things, and they're much better at all of it than I am, but I know enough to be able to tell the story.
94, isn't that about when The Body Farm came out?
Yes.
And Lucy became a gay character. Just knowing what we know about popular crime fiction and popular culture back in the 90s, mid-90s, just trying to imagine what that meeting went like with your editor or your publisher when you were saying, I'm going to make a gay character.
I didn't make her that. She was that. And then I had to tell the truth about it. Literally, I was writing a scene in Scarpetta. I don't make these people anything. And I once had an editor say that in the book where we thought Benton died, but he didn't really, they said, you need to go back. And the last time they're together, they need to have sex. I said, okay, I'll be right back. Let me ask. I asked them, they said Scarpetta would not answer me, which meant a big fat no. And I said, they don't want to have sex. I don't know why you'd have to ask them that question, but I can't change that scene. And so, in fact, they usually don't even let me watch, which is too bad because I'm sure it's quite good. But they let me know just enough to sort of tell you what happened. And the room is usually, the door is locked. I mean, it's you'd be surprised how many places I'm kept out of. In my own mind, twisted as it is. But in the scene about Lucy, Scarpetta's in her living room in Richmond, and she walks in, and I haven't seen Lucy in a number of years, and I'm literally watching this right before my eyes in my head, and I watched her body language, and I said, oh, my God, she's gay. And then I thought back to when she was 10 and always taking computers apart and what a brat and playing with guns and driving pickup trucks, and I said, well, what big surprise is that? So I called my publisher and I said, I think you should know this. You know, Lucy is gay. And she says, well, why are you doing this? I said, I'm not doing it. She did it. Or God did it. And so I said, I don't lie about my characters. I had somebody in publishing wasn't happy about the Newtown thing in this book. Said, you should make it up as a different place. I said, I know this will come as a real shock, but there aren't too many schools with first graders where this exact same thing has happened. And so changing the name is not going to mean anything to anybody. They're going to know what I'm talking about, and I'm not going to lie about it. This happened, and you know something? If my book helps people remember it 100 years from now, then they should. Mm-hmm. I don't go into inappropriate detail. I'm very cautious what I do. But I do tell the truth, even though I write fiction.
Lucy also is an interesting counter to Kay. When they're working together, Kay Scarpetta is procedural, you know, kind of clinical. She has a lot of feelings, but she manages them, whereas Lucy's much more apt to sort of yell out, you know, what she thinks is the answer. And I'm interested in the interplay between those two. And since you have them both close at hand, I just wondered if you could tell us about how that works for them.
Well, we've gotten to a stage in the series where Scarpetta very openly does not want to know some of the things that Lucy does, because we all know that Lucy, and I have said this before, to her, some laws are simply no different than obstructions when you're flying. They're just things you go around. Mm. And she doesn't see the point in them, and so therefore she's a big believer in her own situational ethics, whereas Scarpetta, who's also has a law degree, she has quite a different perspective on obeying the law. So she does not believe it's a good thing to hack into computer systems unless you work for our government. She doesn't think it's a good thing to spy and to do all the things. In fact, Lucy may just go back and work for the government. Maybe that's what I should do in the next book. So there is, all joking aside, there is a certain amount of tension, because Scarpetta has come around to the point of view that Lucy's wired a little differently, certainly than from what she is. It's not something she's always comfortable with, but it is what it is. And she lives with that. They're very different people. That's also why Lucy is really fun, because she doesn't understand fear the same way other people do. And she will get a job done. One thing that you're going to like in Dust, I think, is that you actually see Lucy working a crime scene with her aunt. We haven't seen that in well over probably a decade, maybe 15 years. Lucy used to be FBI and ATF. She got fired by both, big surprise. But she knows what she's doing, and she's quite an investigator, and we actually see her at a crime scene and notice what she's observing in her spin on things, and I think it's a lot of fun.
There's a question from the audience about what you do with your characters. Why can't Kay be happy? I'm rooting for her to be happy after all her trials and tears.
We just always catch her at a bad time. I mean, what do you people expect? The phone rings and wakes you up. You've been sick. You've just been at a mass fatality. And then you're dragged out in the middle of the night to a crime scene. And, I mean, I could try to have a little rock and roll playing on the radio and see if it peps her up or something. But she usually has some pretty dark and foreboding thoughts on her mind. She's very intense. If you could only be around her when she's not working a case, she is a barrel of laughs. But nobody wants to publish a book when she's not working a case. That's in my contract. If she's not working a case, we do not have a deal.
Or cooking.
You have to throw that in there, too. But she's not as... She's really not an unhappy person. She's just very intense, and we catch her when she's in the middle of an absolute life and death emergency.
We have a question here from the audience about your past few Scarpetta novels have taken her to a deeper, dark place in terms of self-introspection and self-doubt. Seems to be impacting her relationship with Benton. Your thoughts on this evolution?
No, she and Benton are doing fine. Don't you worry for 1 minute about that. And I know, because I can't get in her bedroom most of the time. So even if I just want to dust and pick up a few things in there, I can't get through the door. So I think there's several things going on. First of all, she might not be getting older, but I am. And I think as life moves on, you become more reflective. We think more about life and death and who we are and who we were and who we're going to be. So she is much more reflective. Some of that is my allowing her to be so, because, for example, in Dust, in the very beginning, she's very reflective about life and death and spirituality and what is afterlife and what does it all mean. And frankly, these are the kinds of questions a lot of us would like to ask her. I know I'm asked this frequently. You know, you've seen so much death. What do you think about the afterlife? Do you believe in it? I said, no, I believe it's a continuum. I think that there is no beginning or end to the energy and the spirit that is us. And the more dead bodies I've seen, the more struck I've been by how I can look at a photograph of someone who was alive 2 hours earlier, and it still looks like them, but that energy is so completely gone, it's like a burned out light bulb. Where did it go? And I don't think it disappears. And so I actually feel that I have a much stronger sense of the dead not really being gone. We just don't know where they are or how we can relate to them. I don't think as much metaphorically, like streets paved in gold and things like that. But I have very strong spiritual sense of who people are and what they are. And some of that even happened when I was working on the Jack the Ripper book. I was so vividly aware that this evil spirit is not really gone. He still influences people, and sometimes you almost could feel the presence of something very dark when I was working on that book and going through things that he had held in his hand and letters that he had written. So I have a very big respect for the eternity of who and what we are. And she does too.
There are a couple questions here about the Jack the Ripper book. First, how did you get interested in Jack the Ripper?
I got kidnapped, sort of. I had never had any thought of writing about Jack the Ripper. In fact, I'd never even read anything about Jack the Ripper. And then in the spring of 2001, I was in London, and somebody introduced me to a Scotland Yard investigator who, this was one of his specialties, was studying this case, and he started talking about it with me. And then I started asking him questions. And then he took me on a retrospective visit of where the crime scenes had been. And he started talking about the suspects. And I said, suspects based on what? What evidence? He said, based on absolutely nothing. They're just theories that people have come up with, particularly in the last 30 or 40 years. And I said, well, is there any evidence in this case? That was the fatal question I should never have asked. He says, well, yeah. I mean, he wrote letters to the newspapers and the police. And there's still several hundreds of Jack the Ripper letters in the National Archives in a vault. And I said, letters? Well, there's a lot of evidence you can get from letters. And I don't mean just handwriting analysis. I'm talking about possible DNA or forensic paper analysis or the type of medium used, you know, ink or pencil or who knows what. I'd like to, the language. I started getting into it, and there was no turning back, because very early on, I thought that I was on the trail of the person who had done it. And I am actually working on finishing the revision of that book now, some, you know, 11 years later, and I'm more convinced than ever that Walter Sickert, the artist, was in fact Jack the Ripper.
There's a pretty vehement and rather angry, it seems, Jack the Ripper theory community out there, because you got a lot of flack from that community.
I most certainly have, and I will again. And I will offend people mightily. If they want to be offended, then I intend to make it worse this time. Because I am simply, you know what, I'm not spinning a theory. I am showing you a case that is based on extremely precise and detailed investigation and using some of the best scientists to do this work. I'm not the one who did the analysis. I'm not the world's foremost paper expert that says that five letters with a certain watermark that could only have come from 24 sheets of paper, three were Walter Sickert letters and two of them were Ripper letters. So you have five sheets of paper from a batch of 24. That's quite a coincidence. And then you add the pathology that the stationery Sickert wrote on was his mother's, that he stole from her house. He was smart enough to cut off the address off the top of it. I'll give him credit for that. So, you know, people will read this and make up their own minds. I think that you can't ever literally ironclad place them at a crime scene. Too much time has passed, and they did not save evidence back then like we do today. Mm-hmm. The clothing of the victims was just thrown into the alleyway of the dead house. They didn't know you could tell anything from it. Oh, my God, if only we had that now.
We'll be back with more Writers on a New England Stage with Patricia Cornwell and ask the best-selling author about her life as a writer, a wife, and a public figure. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special edition of Word of Mouth. Today, NHBR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with Patricia Cornwell, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Through 21 best-selling novels, forensic pathologist Kay Scarpetta has examined the bodies of dozens of crime victims. The dead, she maintains, don't lie. Patricia Cornwell, the creator of these detailed, deep-tissue scenes and the crimes which precipitate them, is anything but morbid. We found her to be vibrant, wry, thoughtful, and grateful for her enormous success. A well-publicized lawsuit against a Boston financial firm this past spring put parts of Cornwell's private, extravagant lifestyle on display.
Cornwell claimed they were so negligent with her money that she was worth only $13 million at one point, despite years of making eight figures. The defense tried to argue Cornwell's lavish lifestyle, including Ferraris and a $40,000 a month apartment, was to blame.
In February, a Boston jury awarded Cornwell almost $51 million in the suit. Cornwell says that the character of a slimy financier in Dust was inspired in part by that case. Still, she declined to talk about it at Writers on a New England Stage, which was her only appearance in front of a live audience for this book in the country or in the world. Earlier in the program, Patricia Cornwell spoke about some of the strengths of her female characters. On stage at the Music Hall, she opened up about her own power, her privilege, her values, and choices.
Listen, I just try to tell the truth. And I mean, anybody who looks at me doesn't think the word thrifty doesn't come to mind. I have never been known for being thrifty except when I was really poor. And then that was of necessity. And I've never pretended to be thrifty. But I also, I'm not like crazy foolish with money, despite what some people might think and some things that have been in the news. And most importantly, I do a lot with my money that's not about me. And it may not be something that anybody even knows about. But I try to live a responsible life, that if I'm going to drive a really expensive car, then I'm also going to put some kids through college or help people who have needs or help animals in distress or do a lot of things to make the world a better place than it might be otherwise. It might not be something that you know about, but are things I've done. I've given away a lot of money over the years. So therefore, I feel okay if I buy a nice pair of shoes or now and then drive a Lucy car. And I really have to do that for the research.
But in this book, you have a very shady financier who lives a very opulent life. And there's a lot of criticism for him in the book. You know, there are people who say things like, well, he could afford a $100 million suit. There's not a lot of sympathy for people with a lot of money.
Listen, I don't have problems with people who have a lot of money. I have problems with people who are greedy. I'm sorry. I hate greed. I do not lie about it. I cannot stand to see it. There's a reason it was a deadly sin. In fact, I don't mind gluttony, but greed bothers me. Because people who are all about money and don't care about anybody else, and they can drive right past someone who's hungry and poor, and it doesn't bother them. And so greed is really what Scarpetta is on the warpath after in this book. And yes, greed, this results in murders and in cases, and I show you all the ugly spoils, but when she finally gets to this one crime scene towards the end of this incredibly rich, rich person who is absolutely evil, you're going to love what she does. Let me put it this way. And he got what he deserved. I did not care what happened to that guy.
And she works the crime scene with Benton, which is kind of interesting.
And Lucy, that's where Lucy is. And she goes all through this person's house because she's looking for a very peculiar weapon based on the injuries that she saw. And no, I'm not nice to this guy. Mm-mm.
Well, another thing that people are curious about is your home life or your personal life. Your wife, you're married to a woman. As a very visible, successful lesbian, do you get called in for a lot of causes? I mean, did you get hit up for DOMA or gay marriage? Do those things come to your doorstep?
We get requests, and I call us partners because we are absolutely equal. And have a absolutely the best, wonderful relationship and the best friendship you could ever imagine. So I'm so lucky to have Stacy. The way I feel about it is I'm very open and honest about it. It's not something that I parade around as a huge cause, because what I try to just live a normal life so that it's an example to people that why do we make such a big deal out of all this? It frustrates me when one part of somebody's life becomes sort of represents the whole, because that's just not really the case, unless you want it to be. So I feel like if you lived next door to us, you wouldn't even notice this about us anymore. We're just people. Mm.
How about that fixation, though, that people want to understand that part of your life? I mean, does that ever get too close to you? Do you ever feel oppressed by that?
I try not to go into those negative airspaces about feeling oppressed or saying, gee, I hate that I have no privacy anymore and fame is terrible, because the fact is most of my life is nothing but a lot of privilege. And with it comes some discomfort sometimes. It's a little frustrating when you do interviews, particularly print interviews, and it seems like 50% of the questions about your being gay. It's like, fine, I'm happy to talk about this some, but wouldn't you like to know something else? Because I'm a lot of things, and I've lived a lot of things, but we are still at a stage in our society where this is more of an oddity than a normal thing, unfortunately, because you wouldn't be asked about it so much if people really thought it was that normal. And that saddens me. It's the same thing when people talk about, especially in the early days when I was called, you know, a successful female crime writer. And I said, but you don't talk about a successful male crime writer. Why do we have to categorize? Why can't we just talk about us as being human beings? But we're farther along than we used to be, and that's the good news. And I'm hoping that another 10 or 20 years we're going to be even so much farther than we are today, that maybe we don't have to think in terms of people being a certain thing, black, white, gay, straight, whatever.
In this book, there is this undercurrent of mistrust for the media, for Channel 5, especially WCBB in Boston, but also for the internet and how information and misinformation is spread around. And I wonder how real that is for you as somebody who has been the target of internet campaigns or hatred.
Oh, sure. It's very common. I think it's common for everybody. You know, I grew up in a town of 200 people. And what's so wonderful about that is I will never be as famous as I was back then because everybody knew my grades and whether I picked their daffodils when I went through their yard, which I did. And my mother got called, and then I was spoken about it after church, or I got dragged to the mayor's office. That I kid you not, several times I got dragged to the mayor's office by my mother because I was a naughty pants and I did things and I had to apologize, such as, you know, taking popcorn out of the machine because I figured out a really great technique to do it. If you got a stick and you open the little thing and pull out a bag, scrape, scrape, and I thought mother would be so happy that I got free popcorn. Well, that was not a good experience for me. And I learned thou shalt not steal at a very young age. So what I'm trying to say is whether you have 15 people who follow you on Facebook or 500,000, your world is as big as your world is. And so you don't have to be famous to be really affected by ugly things people put on the internet. It could be a bad review for your restaurant, and you know your competition put somebody up to it. Or it could be bullying. We see plenty of that. So I just really try not to go into that corner of, woe is me, I have so many more problems than other people. Mine might be on a bigger scale per capita in terms of numbers of people that throw hate bombs, but it feels what it feels like to everybody. I don't think it feels any different for me than it does for anybody sitting here. It never feels good.
Well, if Wikipedia is correct, which I read on the internet, of course, that you were raised in a conservative Christian household.
I was.
So
that's why the popcorn thing was a really bad move.
Well, how about coming out as gay?
That would be frowned upon in my town as well. I'm sure they had me on a wanted poster in the post office there. I have not been invited to do a book signing, so, you know. I grew up being everything that I was taught was wrong. Hmm. The books that I write, this is not something a nice little Presbyterian schoolgirl should be writing. I was brought up that the best thing that could happen to me is to get married and have children and meet some nice man who would support me and not do anything in life. I didn't need to do anything. And from the get-go, I never fit in that mold. I mean, I was out playing baseball with the boys, and then I was playing tennis tournaments, and I was always trying to be somebody. I wanted to have a life that made me feel like I was here for a reason.
I wonder what that feels for you now. People have read 100 million of your books. You are a model for so many. And you've been courageous enough to talk about dealing with bipolar disorder. So again, something that people must hang on you. Tell us about that experience for you. How do you manage that?
Well, I will say just literally, I don't want to get into diagnoses and all this because, look, I definitely have issues with moods. And so I do understand that, and I'm actually glad. I mean, almost any hardship that I've had in my life, if you asked me if I would get rid of it, if I could, I would say no, because it's made me who I am. And I actually think with as many good things as I've had happen, if I didn't have a certain fabric that was very weather-beaten and therefore empathetic, I'd probably be a real jerk. And I might be, but, you know, I have too many other things going on to have time or the interest in being a jerk. And I know what it is to be sad and to feel like a failure and to not have you know, a family structure that really works, or to be depressed and not know why, or to have an eating disorder like I did when I was a teenager. I know enough of the darker side of life to not let the good things that have happened to me change me into somebody I shouldn't be. And one of the reasons I think that Scarpetta is such a crusader is that I feel that in all of my books, they need to do more than just entertain you. I want them to make a difference somehow. And maybe somebody would think they make no difference at all, but I feel that I'm adding, I don't want to use morality as a word because it's so misused, but there's a substance that you get from spending time with Scarpetta that goes beyond you're just being entertained by her. I think she makes the world a better place.
There's a scene in the book, Kay's in the Pit, and I know the title of the book is Dust, and you who are going to read it are going to find out what that dust is. But there's this other mention of dust that I just thought you wrote about beautifully, if you don't mind my reading it. People fail. Everything fails. The magic we're born believing in and working for and then doubting and finally fearing eventually rusts, rots, fades, breaks down, withers, dies, and turns to dust. And for me, the response is always the same. That is really a profound thought. How do you consider this?
What she's really talking about there, and what I'm talking about, is the material world does turn to dust. That's why if you don't have the right values, you're in big trouble. I mean, we all care about nice things and the way we look and our ambitions and accomplishing something, but I think Scarpetta digs in as deep as you can go to say what really matters. And for her, what really matters is the life in front of her. And this goes back to very early experiences with me where I had one person who, when I was at my worst point, you know, when I had just come out of a hospital because I was starving myself to death and I couldn't play tennis anymore because I was too weak and I dropped out of college and I was such a failure that I really just hoped I would die because I thought there's no reason for me to be here. I'm just useless and miserable, and I'm not good at anything. And then one day, the phone rings, and it's Mrs. Billy Graham, who was the biggest celebrity. She was like the first lady. She was so famous, and she lived in our town. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, I was going to go to Pizza Hut, wondered if you'd like to come along. And I thought, why would she care about me? This lady, she lived up the road, but I was just a neighbor who, in my brother's hand-me-downs. I mean, why would she bother with me? And she bothered with me because someone had told her that I was in trouble. And she picked me up, and she put this big, beautiful leather journal in my lap. And she says, I've heard rumors that you're quite a writer. She said, I'd like you to write. I want you to start writing, and I want to read what you write. And she took me to lunch, and she changed my life. So what I say, and this is what Scarpetta does, whether the person is dead or alive, you pay attention to that person in front of you, and you give it all you've got. Because if you change even one life on this planet, you've changed the world. You've left it better than you found it. And that's what she means about dust, is that it's great to have a car and to be beautiful, but never forget what really matters. It's us giving to each other and having it become a circle.
Well, a final question. Obviously, to go from that young woman who walked out of the hospital to where you are now takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of will, it takes a lot of something. If you hadn't met that woman, Kay Scarpetta, would you be the person that you are today?
No. She's made me a better person because I have to think about things that are really good and decent and honorable when I work with her. Here's the best thing about Scarpetta. She's not perfect, and if she were, we would not want to eat at her house and go have a few drinks with her. She's fun, trust me, and she's not perfect, and she would tell you she's not perfect. But the one thing that Scarpetta will not ever do is abuse power, and that is the root of all evil. Abuse of power is to make something suffer and die because you can. And she sees it every day in her work. So even if it's the way she treats her administrator or the person who helps her in the yard or a dog that's been abandoned, she will never abuse the power that she has at that moment. And if all of us would be this way, if the world would be this way, we wouldn't have wars. We wouldn't have murders. That's not going to happen, but it should be a goal we at least aspire to as best we can.
Please join me in thanking.
Thank you,
Patricia.
Thank you.
Cornwell, for an amazing evening.
Thank you.
I can't seem to face up to the fact.
best-selling crime fiction writer Patricia Cornwell, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. Writers on a New England Stage is a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. Producer and communications director is Margaret Talcott. New Hampshire Public Radio president is Betsy Gardella. NHPR's broadcast producer, Taylor Quimby. Our digital producer, Sarah Plord. The Music Hall production manager is Jana Morris. Live sound and recording engineer, Noah LaFave. Musical director and band, Bob Lord and Dreadnought. You can listen to more author interviews from the series at wordofmouthradio.org. Just click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this has been a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.